From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Happy July 4th on this holiday edition of Fresh Air, the music of Bobby Darin. We rebroadcast our interview with Nick Vinay, the co-producer of the new Bobby Darin CD box set. Vinay got his start in the business along with Darin in New York's Brill Building, where the two shared an office and a broom closet. They remained close friends, and Vinay produced many of Darin's records. Also on this big summer movie weekend, film critics Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel share some stories that show how the movie industry has changed in the time they've been writing about it. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you're not already a Bobby Darin fan, a new box set of his work might convert you. It brings together the different phases of his career: rock and roll, pop, big band, Vegas, folk rock, and country. His hits like Dreamlover, Beyond the Sea, Mac the Knife, and If I Were a Carpenter are included along with lesser-known recordings, such as his duets with songwriter Johnny Mercer. Darin died in 1973 at the age of 37 of a heart condition. My guest Nick Vinay, one of Darin's closest friends and musical collaborators, co-produced the new box set. They met as teenagers when they were first trying to make it in the music business. Vinay later produced many of Darin's records. The list of other performers Vinay discovered and or produced includes the Beach Boys, Linda Ronstadt, Ricky Nelson, Gene Vincent, Glenn Campbell, and Sam Cooke. Let's get started with Darin's first big hit. This is Splish Splash, recorded in 1958.
Splish Splash, I was taking a bath long about a Saturday night. Yeah. Rubbed up, just relaxing in the tub, thinking everything was all right. Well, I stepped out the tub, put my feet on the floor. I wrapped the towel around me and I opened the door. And in a splish splash, I jumped back in the bath.
Nick Vinay, welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, thank you.
Do you know the story behind why and how Bobby Darin recorded this song?
Well, Bobby wanted to be a crooner. He wanted to be a pop singer. But he knew he had to do certain things to get on the charts and sell records. And this was his way of taking a shot at it to at least get some fame going, so he could move into where he eventually made it. And this was worked out. He knew what he was doing when he made this record.
You know, it's I'd be lying if I said it's a favorite of mine. I think his rhythm in it is really great, but it's really a dumb song. And I was thinking, when I was listening back to it, who foisted this song about on him, when I realized he wrote it?
He wrote it. He wrote it. He was inspired by a title that disc jockey's mother gave him. And he always said he wrote the song in 10 minutes, but he was saying that because the song shouldn't have taken more than 10 minutes. He worked very hard on this song. He just put everything in it he thought would make it a hit.
Now, I want to play the demo of another early hit that he had, Dream Lover. And, wow, this demo's great. His singing on it is so good, and it's much more stripped down. It's very stripped down, so it's different from the very produced hit recording of the song. Now, tell me the story behind this demo.
Well, he felt that if the song didn't make it with people, if they really didn't get the message with just him and a guitar. By the way, the guitarist is Fred Neil. At that time, Fred had written a song called Candyman for Roy Orbison, and he also wote Everybody's Talking for the Schlesinger film, Midnight Cowboy. He wanted to try something which wasn't being done at that time. Everything was very, and that period of time, everything was cute and pretty. And he wanted to do something that was not cute, not pretty, but worked on another level. And he tried it with just the guitar to see how it would affect people. And it affected everyone. And he knew he had a song that would possibly transcend a certain amount of time. And he made the demo at the session with just Fred playing the guitar. And then later on, everybody asked him to add more. And he did. And he went on. And, of course, it was a hit. Either version will make it for me, too. But that version's real special because it's just Bobby and the guitar, and he sings it as well as he sang anything else.
Well, let's hear the previously unreleased demo version of Dream Lover, written and sung by Bobby Darin and featured on the new Bobby Darin box set.
Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms, 'cause I need a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Dream lover, where are you with a love oh so true, and the hand that I can hold and feel you near as I grow old. 'Cause I need a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone.
That's Bobby Darin's 1959 demo of his song Dream Lover. My guest Nick Vinay co-produced the new Bobby Darin box set when was Bobby Darin's longtime friend and sometime producer. How did you meet Bobby Darin?
We were both in our teens, I guess, and we were working at the Brill Building in New York. The Brill Building was the music mecca of pop music, I guess, at that time. And it was centrally located, and we met a lot of people, like Burt Bacharach had an office there, Lee Brinstoller had an office there, and Darin and I rented a broom closet and converted it into an office. And we just wanted a place to put our names on the door. And he wrote songs, and I tried to put records together. The word producer was not being used at that time. And we actually met in the elevator at the Brill Building and several times, and we ate in the same restaurant around the corner. And we just became friends, and a group of us, really. And we started hanging out and using the broom closet as a place to meet. And we kept a piano in there and a place to write and play demos.
So is that where he wrote some of his early songs?
Yes, that's where he wrote all the records we've heard so far. He worked in that little closet, the size of a broom closet, held a piano, and that's about it, and two chairs. And he would work to 3 or 4 in the morning on these songs.
What were his aspirations then, and what were yours?
Mine was, except the word producer wasn't, was to direct records and create records. And Darin always wanted to be nothing other than a songwriter and sometimes performer. And songwriting was his main goal at that time. I think that's because being a star or a hit artist probably was too much of a fantasy. Sometimes you have a dream that's too heavy to carry. But being a songwriter was more realistic, and he wanted to be a songwriter. That was very important to him.
How much faith did he have in his singing?
He had more faith in his songwriting than his singing, but as the first couple records he made, of course, you know, did not sell very well. They were bombs. But as he progressed, he felt stronger about his singing, and at some point he decided that he's going to have to do it with his songs because he just felt that he had the interpretation he couldn't give to other people when he just wrote them.
Although he started off with rock and roll hits, he seemed to know early on that he wanted to sing standards and probably end up in Vegas. Now, a lot of rock and rollers in the late 50s and early 60s were groomed to play Vegas, but often against their will. But the feeling was rock and roll is a fad, and unless you learn how to play Vegas, you'll be out of a career by the time you're in your 20s.
Well, you're correct.
Yeah. You know, go ahead.
That particular time period, you know, we were still coming out of the late 40s. The influence in the 50s was from the adults in the late 40s. And singing was legit singing, and you had to play in a club, and you had to play Vegas, and those venues, or you weren't a success. And if you didn't learn to play those places, you would end up doing one-nighters with 20 other acts that had one hit on various disc jockey shows in small towns. And a lot of the rock and rollers could not do the pop situation, and a lot of them could. And the transition was tough for some. There was Paul Anka who made the transition, and it was very few of them, really. And Darren made the great transition.
You know, for a lot of people in rock and roll, listeners and performers, Vegas symbolized everything that was square and unsavory about show business. Why did Bobby Darin want that?
Well, Darin thought that he could actually bridge the gap and bring his audience, and the word teenagers is the word they used, people under the age of 25, he could actually bring them up to where they too would appreciate Sinatra. They'd appreciate Tony Bennett. They'd appreciate pop music. And he tried to cross it. He tried to keep the rhythm and the tempo for dancing situations and for the excitement. And later on, when you get into Mac the Knife, you'll see he did it.
Well, we should hear Mac the Knife. Now, he recorded this when he was 23.
23.
And I know when I heard it when I was young, it was catchy. I don't know. And then in college, I was introduced to the Three-Penny Opera, and I thought, boy, that Bobby Darin, he really ruined Mac the Knife. He made it into a showbiz anthem. How horrible of him. And when I listen to it now, I think, what a great recording. What incredible rhythm he has in this. I mean, he transforms the song, but yes, he does something really interesting with it.
And I must tell you, that's his concept. It was his idea, and everyone thought he had lost it.
That he was crazy?
He was crazy. They thought they just couldn't believe that he was going to do that, and he did.
Well, why did he choose this song? What did he hear in it? What did he hear in it to swing it? I mean, it's not a song that you think of swinging.
Well, we're dealing with a guy that could go back to the 20s. He knew Frank Tashmatter and Johnny Dodds and the early Dixieland musicians. He was steeped in the music business history and various forms of music. And he loved, personally, Dixieland. Had he had his druthers, born 20 years earlier, he would have been a Dixieland. He would have had a Dixieland band. And what he did is he loved these tunes, Kurt Weill tunes. He just loved them because they were German umpah tunes, you know. They were kind of done in that old style for the show, of course. And he just loved the whole theory, the way the song was written, the mysterious lyrics, you know, their various levels. He thought he could get away with it, and he did. And he was just brilliant.
Well, let's hear Mac the Knife is recorded by Bobby Darin in late 1958.
Oh, the shark, babe, has such teeth, dear, and it shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has old Maggie Heath, babe, and it keeps it out of sight. You know when that shark bites with his teeth, babe, scarlet billows start to spread. Fancy gloves, though, wears old Maggie Heath, babe, so there's never, never a trace of red. Now on the sidewalk, ooh, Sunday morning, lies a body just oozing life. Eek! And someone sneaking round the corner. Could that someone be Mac the Knife? There's a tugboat down by the river, don't you know, where a cement bag just drooping on down. Oh, that cement is just, it's there for the weight, dear. Five will get you 10, old Mackie's back in town.
He disappeared, babe, after drawing out all his hard-earned cash. And now Maggie Heath spins just like a sailor. Could it be our boy's done something rash?
Ho, ho!
Yes, Sugi Tawdry. Ooh, Miss Lottie Lenya and old Lucy Brown. Oh, the line forms on the right, babe. Now that Maggie's back in town. I said, Jenny Diver. Whoa, Sugi Tawdry. Look out to Miss Lottie Lenya and old Lucy Brown. Yes, that line forms on the right, babe. Not that Maggie's back in town. Look out, old Maggie is back.
Bobby Darin singing Mac the Knife. We'll hear more from Nick Vinay, co-producer of the Darin CD box set, after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Nick Vinay, and he co-produced a new box set of Bobby Darin's recordings. And he knew Bobby Darin from the time they were both teenagers till Bobby Darin's death, and he produced many of Bobby Darin's records. What did the success of Mac the Knife prove, and how did it change his career?
Surprisingly, it didn't change his personality, but what it did change is his thinking. He realized that he had that thing that artists get when they get into the center. They know that their creative ideas are right if they just don't let outside people talk them out of it. And they use their gut feelings. And then he started using his own feelings for picking types of songs and making albums, and it worked. He just avoided talking to too many people because they all had ideas of what was wrong with it. He just wanted to know what was right with it. And so that really gave him the that feeling that he's right and he's an artist and he can come up with great ideas if he keeps them intact.
Now, he was supposed to record Donkashane after
Yes, he was.
But instead he gave the song to Wayne Newton, and of course the rest is history.
Darin was producing Wayne. Darin had signed Wayne Newton. Wayne was brought to Bobby by Dick Clark, believe it or not, in New York. And we went down to see him playing in a lounge, and he was just terrific. And Bobby signed him as his first act on his Capitol production deal. Bobby was banking for the future. He wanted to produce, and he wanted to publish, and he wanted to run a record company and slowly over the years taper off from performing, which at that time was becoming more difficult for him physically. And he just didn't want to make it public, so he started getting more involved in production. As you know, Darin didn't have a lot of years.
Well, I'm going to skip playing Wayne Newton's Donkashane because I want to save as much time as we can to play Bobby Darin's
you.
Music.
Cut that part out, but I don't blame you.
So how did Bobby Darin actually make it to Vegas?
Well, Steve Blauner, his manager, introduced him to George Burns. And George Burns just, you got to understand, Darin, when he walked in the room, he had that presence, that great spirit. Very few people have it, but when they have it, you know it. They walk in a room and everybody stops. They may not be facing the door, but they stop. And George Burns met Darin, and he just felt that thing that Darren had, that this kid is going to be a star. And Darren had already had a couple of records on the charts. And Blauner told Burns that if you take him to Vegas, you won't be disappointed. And he did. And Darren just lit up Vegas. You know, he was one of the highest paid performers ever in his 20s in Las Vegas.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, he packed it in. Darren was truly a phenomenon in Las Vegas. It was unbelievable.
Were you in Vegas, too, at that time?
Oh, we used to go up there all the time. Remember, we're two kids, two poor kids from the city. I'm from Baltimore, and he's from New York. And this was dog heaven for us. We were raised that you're successful. You drive Cadillacs. You wear a gold-link bracelet on your left hand to tell you who you are. And you wear one on your right hand to tell you who you were. And we did it all. We were foolish like that, but it was worth it. And Vegas to us was just the cat's meow, I can't tell you. We didn't even think it was gaudy. We thought it was neat. We were in our 20s, you know. And it was very exciting because we came from very good people, but very simple neighborhoods.
Well, you know, in his Vegas period, he recorded a lot of jazz standards. And I want to play one of my favorites, which you happen to co-produce. And it's A Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square. I think this is a wonderful recording and shows how good his jazz singing is. You were at the session. You co-produced it. Why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Darren had a great ear and a great respect for other writers. A lot of writers do not listen to other writers, nor do they care about other writers' works, and a lot of artists who write don't listen to other writers or their works. Darren had one of those great feelings about other talent, and he was just always just excited about great writers and a lot of writers and a lot of the great songs. And this particular song is one that he felt he could never, ever write a song like this, and the next best thing would be to sing it. He loved it so much, and he did.
So this was recorded in 1962, and Billy May is the arranger and conductor on this, and of course he did a lot of work with Frank Sinatra and many other singers as well. So why don't we hear A Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square?
That certain night, the night we met, there was magic abroad in the air. There were angels dining at the Ritz, and a nightingale sang in Berkeley Square. I may be right, I may be wrong, but I'm perfectly willing to swear that when you turned and smiled at me, nightingale sang in Berkeley Square. The moon that lingered over London town, poor puzzled moon, he wore a frown. How could he know we two were so in love? The whole darn world seemed upside down. The streets of town were paved with stars. It was such a romantic affair. And as we kissed and said goodnight,
Bobby Darin recruited in 1962. The new Darin box set was co-produced by Nick Vinay. He'll be back in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more of the music of Bobby Darin. And the summer blockbuster movie season is in high gear. We talk about how Hollywood has changed with film critics Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel.
I'm not the guy who cared about love, and I'm not the guy who cared about fortunes and such. I never cared much, but look at me now. And I never knew the technique of kissing. I never knew the thrill I could get from your touch. Never knew much, oh, look at me now. I'm a new man, better than Casanova at his best. With a new heart, brand new start, I'm so proud I'm busting my vest. So I'm the guy who turned out a lover. So I'm the guy who laughed at those blue diamond rings. One of those things, oh, look at me now.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our interview with Nick Vinay. He co-produced the new Bobby Darin CD box set. Vinay and Darin met as teenagers and remained close friends until Darin's death in 1973 at the age of 37. Vinay also produced many of Darin's records. Did Vegas change Bobby Darin's personality, and did success change him?
Success never changed Darin. Vegas never changed Darin. Politics changed Darin. That's what changed Bobby Darin. His political awareness and growth and his involvement in politics. He went from being a kid raised in the center to a kid that practically became a bomb-throwing leftist politically. And meeting the Kennedys also altered his life. And it altered his ability to play Vegas under certain conditions. Number one, he wanted Vegas to integrate more. He wanted to see more black Americans working at the tables, working in the orchestras, working at the various other jobs, other than the jobs where you didn't see anyone, those faceless jobs in the back. And he became a civil rights worker, quietly.
Did this political awakening lead to the folk part of his career?
Yes. He wanted to stay with the audience that started with him, and he wanted to make the transition with them. For instance, it was okay for you and I to, I don't know how old you are, so I don't know if you were there. He wanted, if I could take and start wearing Levi's and letting my hair grow long and started campaigning for Kennedy, he thought he could do that too, and he didn't understand why people would say he's trying to become a folky. They didn't say Dylan's trying to become a folky. It didn't say I was becoming a folk producer.
But they thought it was phony that somebody with a Vegas pedigree at this point was
yes.
growing their hair long and
yes.
singing folk songs.
And it's an interesting thing. He was willing to lose half his audience
mm-hmm.
for his political conviction. But there was a point there when he lost almost all his audience because one group didn't like him going that far to the left, and the other group on the left didn't want him coming over because they didn't trust him. He was in between a rock and a hard place.
Let me actually play one of his folk songs, one of the songs that he wrote and that he used to close his show with, and it's called Simple Song of Freedom. Now, we're going to hear a demo version of it, I believe previously unreleased, that's featured on this box set. And you were there when he recorded the demo. In fact, I think the tape machine was on your lap.
Yes.
Tell us about this.
Darin had been working on the song, and what he wanted to write was This Land Is Your Land. He wanted to write a song that people could take with them, they could sing with them. And he worked very hard to simplify this. And it's a statement of the time. I get very emotional when I think of it. But he finished it that morning, and he put it on the tape recorder. I held the tape recorder on my lap and held the mic up, and that was the final version. In fact, there's a mistake in it, but he kept going. And he said, "That's my anthem." And he closed his shows forever after that with that song.
Why don't we pause here and listen to Bobby Darin's demo of his song, Simple Song of Freedom.
Come and sing a simple song of freedom. Sing it like you've never sung before. Let it fill the air, tell the people everywhere that we the people here don't want a war. Hey there, Mr. Black Man, can you hear me? I won't dig your diamonds or hunt your game. I just want to be someone known to you as me. And I will bet my life you want the same. So come and sing a simple song of freedom.
You know, this the song that we heard, the demo of Simple Song of Freedom, his actual studio version of that wasn't released until after his death.
Yes, yes.
And there's, yeah, go ahead.
No, it's just that there were a lot of things on tape that weren't released during his lifetime. He just felt sometimes he wasn't ready to release it, and he had so much he wanted to do, he was afraid to release a lot of things. It might hurt his schedule. And he was a man racing against time, I promise you.
He died of a heart condition. How long was he aware that he had a heart condition? Did he always know that?
Yes, he did. He knew that from when he was a small kid, when he was in his when he was 8 or 9 years old, he understood that. He also understood he wasn't going to make it to 21. And then the new diagnosis said 30. We're the exact age, and he passed away at 36, 37. He outlived the sentences they gave him of how long he was going to live, but he also knew that he had pressed his luck. We did a lot of gambling. We loved Las Vegas, and he used to say, "I'm playing it like it lays." Towards the end there, he used to say, "Boy, I'm pressing my luck, but I'm going to double up." And that was his phrase all the time. He said, "We'll go in the studio. I'm going to double up and see if I can do an album while I still have the energy." He was wearing down towards the end.
You co-produced the new box set of Bobby Darin's work, which is divided into his rock work, his pop work, and his folk and country. What was it like for you to sit down and listen back to all of this?
It was tough. It was tough. The mistakes were bigger. The best parts were better, and it's always tough going back. Darin, we shared a lot of philosophy. I know that Darin never grew old, not because he died young. If he was alive today, he still would not be old. Darin was not an old person. He was young. He would have been young now. And going back over these things, you see the amount of time and years and the places. It's very difficult to do a box set. I've worked with other box sets on people I've worked with, but this one was the toughest because we had put so much time and space between all the songs. We were everywhere: New York, Nashville, Chicago, L.A., Las Vegas, Miami. It was one of those times when this country was on the move. TV was not the king that it is today, nor the glass breast it is today, and there was more entertainment out there.
I'd like to close with a song, and I'm going to let you pick this one. I'd like you to pick and to introduce a song that you particularly love or that has special significance for you.
I'd like to play Beyond the Sea.
And why do you want to choose this?
Darin would go up to Pfeiffer Beach all the time, and Big Sur. And that's where he did his best thinking towards the end. And he would whistle Beyond the Sea on the beach. and I'd walk, a quarter of a mile behind him, because he wanted me to see how the sound sounded when the wind brought it back. He was still planning on recording a new version of Beyond the Sea at Pfeiffer Beach. It just means a lot.
Nick Vinay, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Somewhere beyond the sea, somewhere waiting for me, my lover stands on golden sands and watches the ships that go sailing. Somewhere beyond the sea, she's there watching for me. If I could fly like birds on high, then straight to her arms I'd go sailing. It's far beyond a star, it's near beyond the moon. I know beyond a doubt,
Nick Vinay co-produced the new Bobby Darin CD box set on Rhino Records. Coming up, we talk about movies with Ebert and Siskel. This is the Best of Fresh Air. Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel have spent the past 30 years reviewing movies and the movie industry. Their thumbs are probably the most sought-after anatomical parts of any film critics today. In the movie industry, a thumbs up from them is like money in the bank. They've had a TV partnership for 20 years while writing for competing Chicago newspapers. Their rivalry is at the core of their relationship. Last February, I spoke with Ebert and Siskel in their hometown, Chicago. We spoke in the Thorne Auditorium on the campus of Northwestern University. The evening was a benefit for public radio station WBEZ. Let's start with the pros and cons of being a part-time couple. What?
Better than full-time.
Does that work for you, or are there times that you feel that the dynamics of the relationship kind of ever get in the way of what you want to do, or do you think it
I've enjoyed working with Gene over the years, and I think that what we do, we couldn't do apart. I mean, the dialectic is the whole point of our show. The thing that does bother me sometimes is that people tend to treat us as the two-headed film critic, as if we are one person. We were in a Steven Spielberg movie once. We were a dragon named Siskbert. And I would like to, I'm sure that I speak for Gene as well, I would like to be thought of as a completely freestanding individual person, full service, one-stop film criticism. You can get it from me, you can get it from Gene, and then we come together once a week on the set instead of constantly being asked, where's your partner, as if somehow they're surprised to see you at the movies by yourself.
Right. I want to
talk... Doesn't bother me at all. Not one bit.
Has the relationship changed over the years?
The relationship bothers me, but not the confusion of... let me tell you what it's like. Roger's had one job, basically, for 29 years. Actually, 28 years, 11 months, and only a couple days. I've had...
Ask him square roots. He can do those,
very
too.
Good. Very good. I've had... one job for 26 years and 5 months. And it's a job that requires you to be judgmental. You're judgmental all the time. Now, I'm sitting here in front of people who are bright and are judgmental, but I'm talking, with all respect to all of you who I don't know, we're talking about really judgmental all the time. And Who do you think in the world, what object in the world do you think that we're the most judgmental about other than ourselves? For your listeners, mutual pointing at each other. And it really, we're rough on each other, real rough. And I'm sure that when we're on our deathbeds, if there's time, we'll think, you know what, we were probably too rough. Probably too rough. And
then we'll, the second thought will be, but I'm glad I outlasted him. Because the funny thing is, and Gene is right, we may think that we're friends.
Yeah.
No, we're friends who fight all the time over everything.
I think it's a little more complex than that.
We'll
I think it's more closer to a sibling rivalry, and we both
of the
think
two
we're
statements,
the smarter,
we're friends
brother.
And we fight all the time over everything. Which part of those do you think could be more complex?
Well, we'll probably get back to this okay. A little bit later. I wanted to. We're listening to an interview with film critics Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring an interview with film critics Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel, recorded last February in Chicago at the Thorne Theater on the campus of Northwestern University. As I mentioned when I introduced you, you're the people who really like proved on television that you could do actual film reviews on TV and not just use television, you know, not just use the film as a point of departure to make bad puns and lame jokes about the movie. Nevertheless, when you're blurbed, or you know, when an ad is quoting you, it's always like thumbs up or thumbs mm-hmm. down. So whatever you say, no matter how complex your thoughts are, the industry, what they're looking for is the thumb up, right?
Well, you know,
can you put like a financial value on one of your
Spy magazine attempted it number of years ago, and it was very, very large amount of money. I mean, my recollection, it was in excess of $5 million.
Now, this must be very aggravating
and confusing, since many of the movies we give two thumbs up to don't make $5 million.
Right, right.
I'll tell you one thing about being quoted that way is that I would rather be quoted thumbs up than with some inane excerpt from my review that makes no sense at all. At least thumbs up means I liked it, which is basically what I'm saying.
Okay, is there anything that the industry tries to do, publicists in particular, to try to get a good review out of you, or to try to prevent you from seeing a movie because they're afraid you're going to give it a bad review and that might
yes,
kill the
yes to both of
office.
Those. Mm-hmm. Occasionally, movies are not screened for the press. And this almost always means that they don't think they're going to get good reviews. Occasionally, you get a movie down Periscope, starring Kelsey Grammer. The word was, no reviews for the press. Then they test screened it. They had sneak previews over the weekend, and it tested well. So suddenly they decided to have screenings because they thought, oh, we might get some good reviews. Well, that was, I mean, after all, they're in the business of selling tickets. I don't blame them. I think a studio has a perfect right to show their movie to anybody they want to or not show it to anyone they want to, and I understand that. But that was an example of where they don't want reviews, and they know exactly what they're dealing with in many cases. Paradoxically, a large percentage of the time, the movies they don't screen to the press get good reviews. For example, Tombstone. I don't know if you saw that.
I love Tombstone.
They refused to show it to the press. As a result, it opened on Christmas Day, and we both leave on vacation right after Christmas because you get all the Christmas movies opened, and there's nothing ever opens in January. We had to catch up with it a few weeks later. It didn't get any reviews on its opening day. They wouldn't screen it for the press. It was one of the best movies of the year. Their policy probably denied Val Kilmer an Academy Award nomination. They didn't know it was a good movie. They'd had so much trouble making it, they confused the travail with the result.
Now, related to this, you both have done profiles of actors in addition to reviewing movies. You write feature stories. My experience is that sometimes actors are very temperamental, and that if you're not asking them questions that will help them promote their film, if you go what publicists like to call off-topic, that they'll sometimes get very temperamental and even walk out.
It didn't used to be that way. I mean, the key word in your observation is publicist. When I started, you kind of hung out with the stars. I mean, Gene and I remember a day when John Wayne came to town to see his friend Stephen Fetchett, who was dying in University of Chicago Hospital. And he called up the movie critics and said, come on over here to the Conrad Hilton and we'll drink some tequila and talk. And the four movie critics at that time turned up, you know, with our tongues hanging out, delighted to just sit around and talk with the Duke for a while. Well, these days, of course, with spin control, you'd have somebody feeding him his sound bites, you know. And I've done many interviews in the past where you really got to spend time with a person in an unstructured environment, maybe in an environment where they didn't always look their best. As, for example, the day I spent with Lee Marvin when he was dead drunk. And yet it was a very good story. He liked it. He talked to me again many times later in his career. He thought it was a good story about that day. These days, the publicists only want to present the soundbite opportunity. And the sad thing is, the lessons they've learned in promoting movies are now being used in promoting politicians. And we are getting the same spin control on politicians that we get on movie stars.
Did you have any publicists from Lee Marvin's movie call you up and say, please don't mention that he was drunk. Please don't quote certain things that he
said. Please
don't
mention that the dog came out of his bedroom with a pair of panties in its mouth, and his girlfriend said, whose are those panties? And Lee Marvin said, Michelle, those are your panties. And she said, those are not my panties. And Marvin said, bad dog.
Did anyone ask you not to quote that?
That's right in the story. It's in there.
Any repercussions?
The publicist was there the whole time. He was going out to get more beer.
I got out of the interviewing business because of the influence of publicists to a degree, to a large degree. I was doing them all the time and enjoyed it tremendously. About 6 years ago, I'm guessing, it's about 6 years ago, a film called Postcards from the Edge by Mike Nichols came out, Meryl Streep, Shirley MacLaine. And Mike Nichols and I there's a group of journalists. Mike Nichols turns to me and says, oh, there was a lull. I said, may I ask a question to my colleagues? Because they had limited time. Go right ahead. I said, what do you mean by the last shot in Working Girl, which is a big pullback? I thought it was a great shot, a pullback from the office building. And he said, you know, one of many stories, that kind of thing. Okay. He said, what did you think of the last shot in this picture? Now he's crossing the line because I haven't reviewed the film. It's okay. And I said, well, I normally don't discuss but I'll be happy to. I didn't like it. I said, you summed up everything with a song. You remember Meryl Streep sings a song and everything's hunky-dory and, you know, this is an addiction film and she's even got the relationship going on with Hackman and all that. And I said, this doesn't work that way. And fine. Now he leaves, and I explained to the other journalist, I said, well, you know, I want you to know, I actually liked the picture, it's just that I didn't like the ending. So if you see me give a positive review, I'm trying to protect myself now, please know that it wasn't that my mind changed, but he asked me about one scene, and I told him about one scene, end. The next day, interviews are canceled. And they're too busy. And including
your
Nichols,
interview.
My interviews with Nichols, Streep, not MacLaine. So I go to Shirley MacLaine. I'm steamed. I'm steamed because, come on, this is juvenile. He asked the question. I didn't go around picking on him. I would end up writing him a letter explaining this. I got most everything in my life from writing letters. And I said, he turned around and he did do an interview with me. And I'll tell you what he said, because it involves Roger too. But back to why I got out of the business. Who needs that grief? Okay? Who needs it? Shirley MacLaine said, "Gene, we're all performers, and these interviews are included in our performances. We're trained to charm you, okay? This isn't the real us. This is a performance that we're giving you. All your public cares about is what you think of the movies, not about us. Forget the interviews. Just focus on reviewing." And basically, she gave me I do have a lot of respect for, always did, and it gave me license to do what I wanted to do. And I wrote a column explaining my exiting from the interview process about this story. What Mike Nichols said was, he said, "You guys," he says, I said, "Why are you making such a big deal about me? You know, I mean, you know," he says, "well, because you can actually affect," this comes back to your earlier question, he says, "you can actually affect the box office."
Well, I bet you've learned interesting things about what it means to be a celebrity in America through the own recognition you've achieved as film critics.
A long time ago, I interviewed Michael Caine. He came to America to make a movie called Hurry Sundown with Otto Preminger after having become a success in Alfie and the Ipcress File. And I said, "What does it feel like to be a movie star?" And he said, "You can't go into a dirty bookstore anymore." He said, "I tried it." He says, "In England, we don't have the kind of pornography you have over here, but I'd heard about the stores in Times Square. And so I looked in through the window of one of them. I was curious." You remember Michael Caine at this time was in his 20s, young man, first trip to America.
Yeah.
"I looked in through the window with my trained actor's eye." I wish I could do his Cockney accent. "With my trained actor's eye, I quickly realized that there was no eye contact in a porno store. Everybody looks as tunnel vision. Nobody looks at anybody else. And I realized," he says, "and this is the way an actor would notice this." And I congratulated myself. I said, "Michael, you can walk right in there because nobody will look at you." So I walked right in. But he said, "unfortunately, there was a gent on an elevated stool with a microphone whose job it was to say, 'Okay, gents, this isn't a library. Make your purchases.'" And he got on his microphone and said, "Look who we have in the rubberware section, Michael Caine." And to a degree, that's when he told me that, I was not on television. I didn't realize that's what happens. You can't flip the bird to anybody in traffic. You always have to be nice to people on the elevator because they know who you are and they're going to tell everyone, if you were not nice. And whatever you do, it's going to get back to you or...
And enlarged.
Enlarged, yeah.
Now, has that affected the way you interview movie stars, because you've experienced to some extent?
Well, I'll tell you what has affected me more, and I've thought about that, because the first big star I interviewed was John Wayne, and I was completely intimidated.
Mm-hmm.
It was during the filming of the Green Berets, and there was an overhead shot that was being set up so nobody out of uniform could be visible on this airfield. So they told him on a walkie-talkie that the interviewer was there, and he came walking in full battle fatigues with a helmet and a rifle and a sidearm and a radio and a canteen and grenades and a backpack and boots and knives and, you know, bayonets, walking toward me for about a quarter of a mile. And I couldn't move. I had to wait in the shade. He got up to me, he stuck out a hand, and he said, "John Wayne." And I said, "I know." And later, as I began to interview people of comparable stature who were younger, such as Robert De Niro or Meryl Streep, I realized a funny thing. For all of us, movie stars are the people who were stars when we were growing up. If they're your age or younger, they're just people.
Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel recorded last February at a benefit for public radio station WBEZ on the Chicago campus of Northwestern University. The interview was produced by Art Ellis. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu, Louisa Shafia, and Tracy Tannenbaum. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Thank you.